Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
How, oh, how did it get so crazy out there? Couldn't folks have just planned a little better? I mean, it's just money, right? Oh, you think I'm talking about Black Friday? No, I'm talking about the euro. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
Welcome to the Marketplace podcast for Friday, November 25th. I'm Tess Vigeland. So what did you do this morning? Did you happily sleep through the night? Or did you brave the crowds and the cold to line up at the shopping mall? Well, we talked to a few people in the latter category this morning.
I just want to see Black Friday for myself. I've never participated in Black Friday. I've heard about the craziness, and I thought, why not spend some money, catch the deals?
I've never seen lines like this. We actually just like hesitated and hovered in the middle of the parking, like, do we even really want to do this?
The deals. I mean, I've been doing Black Friday with my mom since I was high, like 15. So I've done it like almost every year.
That was Raven Hunter, Jenny Covello, and Nicole Muir from around San Diego. Of course, Black Friday is not just a day anymore. Some of the big-name stores started their doorbusters as early as 9 o'clock last night, much to the dismay of their employees. And some have been running Black Friday deals since before Halloween. So in that spirit, we are going to look ahead to the next big retail bonanza. Here's Marketplace's Amy Scott.
Dan de Grandpre tracks online promotions at dealnews.com. The website's motto, where every day is Black Friday. And lately, that seems to be true.
Because wallets are tight, retailers are trying to actually get into that wallet sooner.
That goes for Cyber Monday, too. That's the term the National Retail Federation invented to describe the spike in online shopping once folks get back to work after the long weekend. Retailers like Target and Walmart are rolling out their Cyber Monday promotions on Sunday. And for some, the day has stretched into Cyber Week. The problem is, de Grandpre says, shoppers will start to expect everything to be on sale all the time.
So what will happen is that consumers will not really spend any more than they would have anyway.
For now, Cyber Monday remains a moneymaker for retailers. It was Amazon's biggest single day last year. Comscore predicts overall shoppers will spend more than $1 billion online this time around. Analyst Frederick Moran with the Benchmark Company says the Black Friday madness in stores may actually help.
You don't have to have the frustration of standing on a line or waiting for service or being out there in the middle of the night when you should be home sleeping.
And you don't get pepper sprayed. But some trying to sneak in a little deal hunting at the office on Monday may be disappointed. 60% of companies recently surveyed by Robert Half Technology block employee access to online shopping sites. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
We reported yesterday that AT&T and T-Mobile had withdrawn their merger application from the Federal Communications Commission. It seems the deal was giving antitrust regulators a little too much indigestion. The two cell phone giants insist they are not giving up on joining forces. But many analysts say that by pulling their application, the telecom giants acknowledged a merger has little chance of getting the government's seal of approval. From Washington, Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports on what's next for the two companies.
Another sign that the deal is on life support, AT&T announced it will take a $4 billion charge against this quarter's earnings to pay for a breakup fee promised to T-Mobile if the merger falls through. Telecom analyst Jeff Kagan says that's a significant windfall for T-Mobile.
This could be the ammunition that they need to come out shooting.
T-Mobile has been losing customers, but has options now that AT&T's takeover bid is in trouble. Kagan says perhaps a cable TV company, Time Warner or Cox, will see T-Mobile as a way to break into the cell phone business. Or T-Mobile could become a low-priced alternative for a certain type of consumer.
There's still a huge market of customers in the wireless industry that's just not interested in all of the iPhone, smartphone, whiz-bang technology. You know, it's not for everybody. There's still an opportunity for T-Mobile to grow in that other segment of the marketplace.
But the deal's failure is a blow to AT&T's search for new wireless space called Spectrum. Analyst Craig Moffett with Sanford C. Bernstein says without T-Mobile, AT&T will have to compete for limited airwaves with everyone else.
AT&T will have to go back to the drawing board in its search for spectrum, but they are in effect sort of back into the pack, and everyone in this business is looking for additional airwaves.
The court hearing for the Justice Department's challenge to the merger is scheduled for February. Moffitt says AT&T may use the time in between to work out a compromise with regulators. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Another day, another development in the Eurozone debt crisis. And you probably won't be surprised to learn it's not good news. The credit rating agency S&P has downgraded Belgium. Even more worrying, Italy saw its borrowing costs skyrocket. And a senior British official called on banks in the United Kingdom to prepare for the possible breakup of the euro. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Italy's squeaky clean new government is committed to cleaning up its finances, so when it sold some of its bonds today, it may have been hoping for a round of applause from the markets. It didn't get one. Investors instead demanded the highest rate of interest or yield on Italian government bonds in more than a decade. Mark Ostwald is a bond expert with Monument Securities.
The market's saying, well, we're just going to carry on pushing these yields higher and higher and higher until someone actually does something.
Investors know that Italy, with $2.6 trillion worth of debt, is too big for Europe to bail out. The existing bailout fund has only $350 billion left in it. And Raoul Ruparel of the Open Europe think tank says a plan to persuade China and others to put money into that fund has come to nothing.
It's really not clear to countries such as China or sovereign wealth funds around the world what they would be investing in.
Germany hasn't helped. It has refused to allow the European Central Bank to print money and prop up Italian and other Eurozone bonds. The end of the euro in its current form could be approaching. Britain's main financial regulator has told British banks to prepare for the possibility the euro might break up. Jeremy Warner is economics commentator at the Daily Telegraph.
It means that people are beginning now to take very seriously the possibility of a disorderly unwinding of the euro.
The death of a currency.
The death of the currency, yes.
Although he concedes, others have predicted the euro's demise. And yet, for now, the currency staggers on. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
I mentioned the S&P downgrade of Belgium, and there is news today of an important court decision related to the big credit agencies. Reuters reports that a federal judge in Albuquerque ruled credit ratings are not always protected by First Amendment free speech rights. The case involves investors who are suing over money they lost on mortgage-backed securities that had good credit ratings attached to them. On Wall Street, a shortened day of trading to wrap up a fairly miserable week. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Oh, what a week it has been. First, there's never enough gravy at the table, right? Then there's the super committee and its super failure to come up with $1.2 trillion in budget cuts. Germany, the mightiest economy in the European Union, had a less than ideal bond auction. And then, of course, there's the gunplay and pepper spray that marked the start of the year's biggest shopping season. Joining us to wrap up the week's big news on Wall Street and beyond are Lizzie O'Leary from Bloomberg News and John Carney with CNBC. Welcome, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So let's start out with what is going on with this super committee. Super duper, Lizzie. Not.
Yeah, not so much. We were starting to call them the stupor committee as well, of just this sort of sense of inaction. What is going on right now? When they couldn't actually reach an agreement, they announced their failure on Monday. Now we see the approach of what would be these cuts that automatically go into place, take equal whacks from the defense budget, the non-defense budget, but they don't kick in until 2013.
Right.
So that buys Congress a little time to do what it does best, which is try to wiggle out of the situation it got itself in the first place.
And none of that is probably going to reassure these rating agencies, right?
No. And John and I had a disagreement about this the last time we talked about this. Look, the automatic cuts, the ratings agencies say, OK, fine, because that would still be deficit reduction. What they are having, they're keeping their eye on is whether some of these automatic cuts are undone. And that's where we'll get signals next week, particularly from Republicans who do not want to see the defense cuts go into place.
Well, John, we just heard Stephen Beard reporting that there are some countries that are actually thinking about backing away from the euro as a currency. You know, more countries got downgraded today. Do you see any sort of end game to this whole European mess? And if not, what happens?
I think as things get worse and worse in Europe, there's actually a hopeful sign. Watching Germany's credit ratings start or credit watching their interest rates start to climb might actually be a good thing because it may break the German will not to help out in any way. The Euro project is extremely popular with the elites of Europe. To watch it crumble, I think, would be not just heartbreaking, but intellectually devastating. So I think in the end, rather than let it collapse, they will attempt to rescue it. The question is whether they dither too long and it's too late to actually step in and do anything. But the thing to remember is it is within their power to prevent this from happening. They do not need to let the euro crumble. They have a European Central Bank that can act like our Federal Reserve does, be a lender of last resorts to banks, be a lender of last resorts to countries. They're unwilling to do this right now, but when it comes down to it, it's hard for me to believe that they let the euro die just to save the euro, because that's essentially what they're doing. They don't want to print more euros because they want the currency to be strong, yet they'll let it crumble. That doesn't make any sense.
Well, let's finish off by talking not about euros, but about dollars. Of course, this one of the biggest shopping days of the year. I don't know if either of you were out there with the crowds today, but Lizzie.
Oh, God, I hate shopping.
I know, you and me both. So, Lizzie, you know, at this point with, what, 152 million shoppers apparently going out to shop today, are we basically sick of being frugal at this point?
Well, you know, that you can make the argument that we're sick of being frugal or that we are trying so hard to be frugal that now we're spending like crazy at dawn or even pre-dawn.
Yeah.
You know, the traditional number here is that Black Friday, you know, retailers get about a fifth, sometimes even more, of their sales done then. And you do have people trying to take advantage of these big deals. And I think what is different now is that there is a, you know, everybody's competing for the same small slice of the market. So you have one retailer trying to price things lower and lower and lower,
right?
Because, you know, someone's going to buy one present as opposed to three.
Right. Let me set a rare hopeful note here because I rarely ever get to. One of the things I like about hearing people showing up in stores is that this isn't 2008 where even a place like Saks Fifth Avenue had to offer 70% discounts and couldn't get people in. Exactly. And people just weren't showing up in the stores. We had reports of empty parking lots. Discounts at that point weren't working because everybody was hanging on to every last dollar that they had. That's not happening now. So that's at least a little bit of a hopeful sign for the economy.
All right. Lizzie O'Leary from Bloomberg and John Carney with CNBC. Happy holidays, you guys. It's official.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
Coming up on this frenzied day of spending, we ask whether it's possible to buy a better life.
There is a relationship between money and happiness up to a point. But after that point where we've kind of covered the basics, we got a roof over our head, we have enough food on the table, and then after that, it just doesn't deliver the goods.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street can't seem to catch a break even with a shortened trading day. The Dow dropped 25 points, about 0.25%, to settle at 11,231. The Nasdaq ditched 18 points, 0.75%, to end the day at 2441. And the S&P 500 fell 3 points, just over 0.25%, to finish the day at 1158. It was the worst week for stocks in 2 months. The Nasdaq lost more than 5%. The Dow and S&P 500 each dipped at least 4.7%. Bonds fell, and the yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.79%. You are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The U.S. Department of Commerce will release data on single-family home sales during the month of October. In Durban, South Africa, representatives from more than 190 countries, including the U.S., will meet to talk climate change. And don't forget, it's Cyber Monday, the day when internet sales boom as online shoppers check off their holiday gift lists. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Believe it or not, there did exist a time before Black Friday. I remember when. Okay, actually, I don't. But we decided a bit of history might be in order. Commentator Nancy Kane tells us how it all got started.
Black Friday. It's a name that conjures up visions of a financial collapse or perhaps a huge power outage. Hardly the stuff of retail hustle and bustle or large throngs of shoppers hunting and gathering. The term itself has an interesting history. In the 1950s, some factory managers referred to the day after Thanksgiving as Black Friday because so many workers called in sick. The day, noted one industrial magazine, was a disease second only to the bubonic plague in its effects on employees. In the early 1960s, Philadelphia cops used the term to describe the intense crowds of shoppers and traffic that poured into Center City on the day after Thanksgiving. It was hardly a term of endearment. All the people and congestion made police work more difficult. A sales manager, Gimbel, said, watching a cop trying to deal with a group of jaywalkers, "The police think in terms of headaches that it gives them." Still, the term stuck. And by the mid-1970s, newspapers in and around Philadelphia used it to refer to the start of holiday shopping. But its usage continued to carry negative associations. Then, in the 1980s, some enterprising merchants began to turn this around. They did so by pointing to all the black ink that showed up on balance sheets as a result of the day. From here, it was a short hop to the idea that Black Friday was the day when retailers historically came out of the red and went into the black by beginning to turn a profit. In the last 30 years, the term Black Friday has spread, and the day has become an unofficial holiday, although not for most who work in retail. For them, the day has grown longer. And this year, Black Friday became Black Thursday. At Macy's, Beals, and Target, consumers started shopping at midnight on Thanksgiving. But Walmart led the way. It opened its doors at 10 p.m. on the holiday. Who knows? At this rate, Thanksgiving might disappear altogether. Or the month of November will be called Black November.
Nancy Kane is a historian at the Harvard Business School. If you've got a comment, write to us. We're at marketplace.org. Click on the link that says Contact. So there's the history of Black Friday, but if you really think about it, marketers alone can't make us open up our wallets to spend, right? So what is it about us as consumers that drives us to want all those things? Sure, you could blame Madison Avenue, but James Roberts says it is far more complex. He's written a new book called Shiny Objects, Our Obsession with Possessions and the Truth About Why We Buy. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I would wish you a happy Black Friday today, but we're going to talk about how perhaps Black Friday is not all about happiness. Why are we spending the money we don't have to find the happiness we cannot buy?
There's a number of reasons. One is that we've got a lot of people encouraging us that happiness can be bought online, at the mall, or in a catalog. And then there's a lot of other reasons. Security. We feel better when we have things around us. And purchasing can make us feel a little bit safer.
Let's talk brass tacks here then, with money and happiness and where the two actually perhaps do meet. And you talk in the book about how there is an actual cutoff after which money adds very little to our happiness. What is that number and how do we arrive at that?
That particular study that I use says that the figure is about $60,000. There is a relationship between money and happiness up to a point. But after that point where we've kind of covered the basics, we got a roof over our head, we have enough food on the table, and then after that, it just doesn't deliver the goods, pardon the pun.
Well, and I think perhaps we see that. I know that there are other studies out there that show that almost the more money you make, the more you want to make.
Yes.
Because then it feels like it's never enough.
We call that the treadmill of consumption. And we buy our first house. You know, it's bigger than our apartment and it's got 1,200 square feet and it's enough. But all of a sudden that becomes our new norm because we adapt. So all of a sudden now that new norm of 1,200 square feet is what we look at as our frame of reference to the rest of the world. So that ability to adapt both serves us and can undermine our well-being.
Can we frame the discussion slightly differently and ask what the relationship is between our happiness and the amount of debt we have? So we talk about happiness versus how many things we have and what we've bought, but what about debt? Where does that play in here?
These materialistic longings that we have don't just have a negative impact on our pocketbook, but they impact how we feel about ourselves and they impact our willingness to get involved in the community. Really, research tells us those are the real keys to happiness, and materialism is antithetical to all three of them.
So Black Friday is today and the holidays coming right up here. How do you want people to be prepared for what is traditionally the biggest shopping season of the year, the biggest accumulation binge that we have?
What I would suggest is set a budget and stick to that budget. When you go out shopping, use layaway. You know, the great thing about layaway is that it forces you to pay off for your items before you get them. Come January, you avoid that financial hangover.
James Roberts is the author of the book Shiny Objects. Thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you, Tess.
But for all the hand-wringing over our culture of consumption, the fact is that our economy depends on us spending money, and a lot of it. In that sense, indulging your desire to buy a new pair of shoes or the cool smartphone you've been eyeing could be seen as downright patriotic. And that is the thesis of another book by another James. We turn now to James Livingston to talk with us about the other side of the consumer equation. His book is Against Thrift: Why Consumer Culture is Good for the Economy, the Environment, and Your Soul. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I gotta say, you know, this seems to cut against pretty much everything we hear, which is the importance of saving, the value of thriftiness. So give us your argument against thrift.
I'm suggesting that saving and private investment does not drive growth. What does drive growth is consumer spending. The supplement to that has been government spending. So we don't want another crisis driven by surplus capital. So we shouldn't cut corporate taxes. We know that consumer spending does drive growth. So why don't we learn how to accept, embrace consumer culture?
Well, we certainly have embraced consumer culture over the years. I mean, it is arguable that that is what got us into this problem in the first place. You know, people were spending so profligately that they were in way over their heads, putting so much of this on their credit cards. So how can you argue that more spending would actually benefit our economy?
I think what drove us into this crisis is not consumer debt. What drove us into this crisis is the enormous piles of surplus capital that went into bubbles. If net private investment is declining and growth is happening, what do you do with all of these profits? Well, you look for the highest rate of return, and the highest rate of return is typically in risky speculative markets that turn into bubbles. Mm-hmm. That's the origin of the crisis.
The phrase consumer culture, I think, really has come to have a very negative connotation.
Yes.
You think of hypermarketing and overspending. How do you think we should view it?
When we're cooking a meal, for example, or buying a gift, or even rewarding ourselves, say, on Black Friday, Those are moments when we understand that it's our generosity to be nice to others and to be nice to ourselves. It's not very complicated to me.
So you're saying we are actually our better selves when we are spending, which is the complete opposite of what you think of as, you know, the spendthrift American.
Consumers, they know that what they buy immediately depreciates, but for the time being, it's valuable to people. Think of how you treat, say, a Hallmark card. It can be a sign of a loving relationship if you make it particular to this relationship.
We just heard from another author, James Roberts, about how we spend money to basically buy our happiness and why that doesn't work. But of course, your book argues that not only is spending good for the economy, but it's good for the soul.
Right.
Explain that one for us.
We, the human species, discover ourselves through objects, through things, through materials. None of us are really very good at being metaphysicians. And so we embody our desires. We embody ourselves in the world with objects. Now, bettering ourselves, making our souls larger, seems to me that buying things doesn't diminish those possibilities. In fact, it magnifies them.
James Livingston is the author of Against Thrift: Why Consumer Culture is Good for the Economy, the Environment, and Your Soul. Thanks so much for joining us on this Black Friday.
Thanks for having me.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note from the desk of, hello, this is 1998 calling. Groupon went public not even a month ago. You know them, the big daily deal site where you can get coupons for everything from surfing lessons to cupcakes. Well, the stock debuted at $20 a share and went as high as $31 on that first day. Forbes points out for this week, Groupon is down 35%, with a stock price hovering around $17 a share. That is not the kind of discount investors were hoping for. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 25 points, about 0.25%, to settle at 11,231. The NASDAQ ditched 18 points, 0.75%, to end at 2,441. And the S&P 500 fell 3 points, just over 0.25%, to finish the day at 1158. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace's acting producer is Megan Larson, and the executive producer is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yor is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money. Does your spouse keep money secrets?
Things that I feel are important to me, he doesn't necessarily feel are important, and that we could spend that money somewhere else.
I don't know if she actively hides them. It's more like they're hidden in plain sight.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Enjoy your weekend. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.